factors that this proved. American sugar and tobacco companies were nationalized by Castro at an estimated loss of $1.8 billion, and thousands of Americans left Cuba. Castro's anti-American speeches became a symbol of the spirit that said, Yankee, go home. So it was a shock when Cuban crowds gathered to cheer when an American cruise ship sailed into Havana's harbor for the first time in 16 years. Some say the rousing welcome to Havana was planned by the Cuban government, but whether spontaneous or not, the crowd could show that the hate affair between Fidel Castro and the United States is winding down. There's a slow move toward normal diplomatic relations and a rush by American visitors to cross the 90 miles to Cuba. Once there, they find a socialist country unlike any in the world. Sums up the Cuban attitude toward the Yankees who come back. They're proud, almost defensive about their government, and they're eager to convert others. California Congressman Ron Dellums was invited to Cuba in one of the first major steps by the Cubans to make friends in the United States. Dellums was also asked to bring a delegation behind doors that had been officially closed for 16 years.
The question is, can we develop a communication with the tiny nation 90 miles off our coast? Can we find a way to peacefully coexist and cooperatively live? I think that we must.
Dellums came as a congressman interested in foreign affairs and health programs. He was asked to also bring black leaders from different professions to see how the island republic has changed. Louis Barnett was the most unlikely Cuba visitor. He's a capitalist who founded a bank, and he was looking for business opportunities for blacks in Cuba. Oakland, California's Ruth Love is an expert in literacy and would compare Cuba with other countries she toured as head of the United States Reading Program. Attorney Elgin Harris was interested in the legal side of the move to resume trade with Cuba. And the doctor of the group was psychiatrist Alvin Poussant of Harvard University, who's written about medical care in different countries. Our Eyewitness News crew came with the Dellums delegation for a first look at how the Cubans live today. Aside from all the official functions, we met quite by accident a young communist couple planning the new Cuban way of marriage. He joined some of the first American tourists for a spectacular show at the old Tropicana nightclub. And finally, our trip climaxed with a surprise nighttime visit with Fidel Castro. But it was the people and the vitality of the old city of Havana that impressed us first.
Thank you.
Americans have one feeling in common. They're curious about each other. Walking on the streets of Havana, our bandplane quickly attracted a crowd. I don't speak Spanish, most Cubans don't speak English, but there was so much interest in communicating that finally someone who spoke English found us.
Yes. Where did you learn English?
In the United States.
Oh, you live there?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been back?
I was in Oh, about 3 years ago.
You like that?
Cubans treat Americans like long lost cousins. In fact, most Cubans have family members who left the United States when Castro took power. Both split families will soon be able to visit each other again. And if they do, Americans will find their young relatives in Cuba like most kids we have. They love to come for the television cameras. Like their parents, children in Cuba are fascinated with Americans. They asked for chewing gum, a hat, anything for an American souvenir. But they didn't ask for money or food. In fact, we didn't see any beggars in Havana. The government says there aren't any people living in the streets in Cuba because everyone who wants a job has one. Probably even people who don't want a job have one. And the result is that almost everyone has an income, however small.
Cubans seem to have plenty of money to buy goods, but in order to buy it, you have to be willing to wait in line, and sometimes those lines are long, and sometimes the hours are also very long.
This is a major department store in Havana's shopping section, and only before it opened, people had already lined up for a block because there are extreme shortages of consumer goods, and many items are rationed. Cubans were slow to build industry, so appliances are imported or expensive. A plain refrigerator without extras cost over $800. A Soviet black and white television is $900. Underdevelopment is just one reason for the high prices. Another is the distance Cuba must go for its imports. The United States has refused to trade with Cuba since Fidel Castro declared himself a communist, and the two countries became political enemies.
There are supermarkets in Havana, but a lot of things are rationed. For instance, Cubans are allowed 1 pound of meat per person every 9 days, and rice and milk are also rationed, but then you can buy as much spaghetti, fish, or yogurt as your family can afford.
Cuba's worst economic problem may be that it can't grow enough food to feed its people. It may seem inconsistent, but rationing only applies to what you buy in a grocery store. Their favorite way of getting around the limits is to eat out. Cubans who want to steak more than once every 9 days go to restaurants, where, of course, they wait in line. The crowds are everywhere in the city, but they're worst at the bus stop. There isn't enough public transportation, and what cars and trucks do exist in Cuba are in sad shape. Cuba is a car collector's heaven. It looks like a gathering of antique car dealers. Back in 1961, when the United States stopped trading with Cuba, the door was shut on new parts for American models, so as the cars gradually wore out, Cubans put Soviet engines in their 56 Chevys or made parts at home. The result is an almost comic parade of clanking, puffing cars. Since cars are so scarce, even a 20-year-old model is an expensive and treasured possession. As inconvenient as the car shortage may be, producing new ones has low priority in Cuba because of the efforts to raise enough food. Next, we'll tour a farm that is one attempt to solve the country's severe economic problems.
Hey, Debbie, let's go to a party tonight.
Debbie, I want your home down midnight.
Hey.
Standard tour given VIPs to Cuba's show places. The man who's become a favorite unofficial tour guide is Fidel Castro's older brother, Ramon. He's a natural storyteller, the one Castro brother who stayed home during the revolution, taking care of his mother. Ramon gave the delegation a grand tour by jeep of his pet project, a cattle breeding farm near Havana. His job is to beat the trade embargo against Cuba by developing the country's own resources. Cattle have been a success. Cubans say the farm has produced a new strain that can thrive in the tropical heat. But as Ramon Castro tells the story, cattle raising got off to a rocky start in Cuba.
We focus on cannabis and the best cattle farms. It was Palace. It was called $100,000. $100,000 for one
bill.
And it died afterwards.
Fidel Castro likes to tell how his country struggled to get along without United States business and succeeded. But to American banker Louis Barnett, there are serious money problems in Cuba.
They're really out producing, apparently, enough to take care of the consumption needs of the island and of their own people. Their major problem is their inability to be able to produce finished products, which means that they have to export all of their products, basically in raw form, or the majority of their products, and that means that they are not able to get a good price in the real market.
Instead of developing industry, Cubans concentrated on improving the land. Now, before the revolution, 8% of the people owned 7% of the land. Fidel Castro's first step was to take over all farms larger than 166 acres back in 1963. And at that time, most large landowners left the country. Now the government is even asking the small farmers to turn over their land and join cooperatives. How they're convinced to give up their privately owned farms is a touchy issue. Now, the government says the peasants only join the cooperatives voluntarily. And when they do, they're given housing, refrigerators, furniture, television sets, and milk, all free from the government. And for the people in the cooperative, there's a feeling of belonging. Ramon Castro often drops by to show off the peasant housing and serve Cuban rum to his visitors. This family is a favorite of his. When we asked one little girl if she saw many foreign tourists, she said, almost every week. The help from the Soviet Union makes many of these government giveaways possible. The Soviets have advanced as much as $2 million a day to Cuba, and these countries want Cuba to become more independent. Trade with the U.S. would help, and Congressman Ron Jones believes the embargo may soon be lifted.
People have gone from Chicago, from Minnesota, and other places. They're going in there now by the droves. And that's because they see a new marketplace, and they see the potential for the selling as well as the buying of goods and services and what have you. Which I think that's going to happen. I think that's going to happen because the economics will dictate that.
Cubans consider schools the other must-see for official visitors because education is the country's pride and joy. This is the Isle of Pines, a school complex of 11,000 students, 35 miles from Havana. Fidel Castro personally arranged for Ron Dellums and Dr. Ruth Love to come here. Work is a required part of school in Cuba. These students live here and work in the grapefruit fields 2 hours a day while attending high school full time.
It's an island that has a special personality because apparently it's the Cubans' attempt at building a new community with, I guess, 35 schools being built in the last 4 years, where students come from all over Cuba to attend secondary schools.
Women, talk, play.
The textbooks do have a lot of political ideology in them. I brought home 4 books from Cuba. I was able to find a lot of indoctrination, even in the math questions, for example.
I would like to ask, what little thing we students plan to do?
What do you think we will continue the revolution in
Cuba? What do you think we will
continue the revolution in Cuba? What do you think we will continue
the revolution
in Cuba? We think that we will continue slowly to develop our country and to help us all as necessary to carry forward the work of our commander-in-chief and to carry forward the work of a socialist revolution.
When you talk to the students there, one has the impression that the revolution occurred yesterday, and they're all caught up in it. There's a spirit of nationalism as opposed to a spirit of individualization here. They are educated to build a nation and to be a part of that. So I would say the revolution is continually through the eyes and ears of the young people. Those eyes and ears take in a friendly political education
But the student's style is strictly Cuban. Uniforms for these young workers for the revolution include short skirts and earrings, and like most women in Cuba, they wear makeup. But concern me greatly that they would take a youngster after the sixth grade away from home. In Cuba, it's necessary for both parents to work. And a few years ago, to my understanding, they found that the students were getting in difficulty after school. So they decided the way to help prevent some of these difficulties was to have these residential schools where not only would they be supervised, but they would also have an opportunity to interact with their peers. So they've tried to make their residential schools as much like small families as possible. Next, we'll see what the future holds for these students in Cuba when they decide to get married and raise a family in the face of a severe housing shortage and a new set of rules about marriage and sharing.
Hi, I'm Jan Hutchinson. This is Mr. Phil Pusher. Mr. Pusher, what do you do for a living?
I'm a con artist, Jan, and I'm fixing up a batch of some street drugs.
What was that?
We met her by accident when she offered to help us find an address near her home. In leaving the conversation away from any of our government escorts, she gave a vivid, unofficial view of life in Cuba. Our first surprise was the collection of Beatles pictures in her room. Armina likes rock and roll, and she also reads American books, most recently Jaws. And she collects magazine pictures of European pop stars. But Armina has another hero, Fidel Castro, who took power when she was just 1 year old. She and her fiancé Jose Lopez are both Communist Party members. Jose and his family came back to Havana from New Jersey after the Cuban Revolution and during the tenth civil rights struggles in the United States. Both are sold on the Castro Society.
And what kind of foreign country do you don't have any money to give? I think we have quite a lot of liberty. You can travel in the country, and you can go wherever you like. You can go to the beaches, none of them is closed, you can't see a sign black and white. This bathroom is for black, and this other bathroom is for white, because I live there. And you don't have anything like that here. Everybody's equal.
A basic thing, I think, is that you can study without problems. You can get your books, your pencils, everything you need. It's very important because you're not happy when you want to read a book and you only have to go to the library and take it.
When the two of you want to go out together, what is there to do? Can you go to a restaurant? How hard is that?
Yes, you can go to a restaurant, you can go to a nightclub,
you can go to the movies, you can go to the zoo, you can go to the beach, you can have a walk, you can look at the horizon, you can look at the sun. Now, even when Jose gets married, they'll be subject to one of the most revolutionary innovations of the Castro government. It's a family code, pushed by women's groups and supported by Fidel Castro. In this Latin culture, the men are told by law that they must share the housework and child rearing if their wives are working. As he said, of course, he plans to obey the code, but added, it doesn't mean he has to mop the floor. And then added, they don't put people in jail for not obeying the code. In reality, a housing shortage forces most Cubans to live with their relatives. So there are many people to share the home chores.
What would happen when you and Joe are married? How do you get a house of your own or come and live here?
The problem of living in houses is very difficult because the government has a lot of hospitals,
for farmers that live in bad conditions.
In bad conditions. But if your house is in a very bad condition, you can go to the offices that attend that problem, I don't know the name, and they will try to resolve the problem for you.
What happens to people like yourself when you get one get married?
In this case, he comes to my home, or I go to
Zia and Marlenis may have to live with their parents, but some lucky people will get new houses.
Wherever you go in Cuba, you'll find new housing being developed. In fact, housing is rated right along with increased health care and better education for all of the citizens. But here in Cuba, you'll find that they've come up with a unique way of getting the massive job of construction done.
Hundreds of apartments are being built all over Cuba by micro brigades, an invention that combines team spirit and expert motivational techniques. Now here's how it works. Workers in a factory will choose 33 of their members to construct a new building. The ones left behind then work overtime for no pay to make up for their absent co-workers. In return, a few of the factory workers will move into the new housing. The lucky ones are selected on the basis of how hard they work and what's called a good attitude. There are even National Hero of Labor Awards each year to the best. Now, women have become a much bigger part of the labor force. There are now four times as many women construction workers as before the revolution, and the benefits are excellent. Pregnant women take maternity leave beginning 6 weeks before delivery and lasting 3 months after at full pay. Daycare centers are free, and so are the schools. Healthcare is also free in Cuba, although people do pay for their own prescription drugs. After the revolution, about half of the country's doctors left. But a crash medical school program now produces 1,000 new doctors a year, half of them women. There are enough doctors to send 100 of them to developing countries every year. Harvard's Dr. Alvin Passant found the healthcare system to be competent.
The people were getting the basic sound medical care, even though not on the kind of luxurious types of conditions. And what I saw there is that there's a emphasis on the people participating in a total way in healthcare. That is, that parents are supposed to be involved with helping to keep their children happy, as well as bring them to the clinics and being with them.
If a child must be hospitalized, the parents can stay with the child in the hospital. Local bloc officials for the Communist Party check to make sure that parents have their children immunized under the free national programs. Cubans say the preventive medicine approach has eliminated polio, malaria, and diphtheria, and has reduced the infant mortality rate to the lowest in Latin America. But to Dr. Hussein, the one measure of success was in how the general population looked.
Wherever we traveled, the people seemed to be in good health. You didn't see a lot of people who looked diseased or poverty-stricken. They had good coloring and good physiques, and I think that's a sign that a healthcare system is working reasonably well.
The healthcare system depends on the efforts of small local groups called CDRs, Committees for the Defense of the Revolution. Their original task was military. The Fidelity delegation met members of one of these groups in downtown Havana who say their role is changing.
And nowadays,
Tenemos un problema de delito a nivel de vecindario.
This is a problem of the policemen. The test is mainly a preventive test. We carry out our guard, we patrol the streets. We know everybody in this neighborhood. We know, for example, the owners of the cars, the neighbors in each street, and every neighbor who is, does not live in this particular street or block. We are just watching
the CDR officials say their emphasis is broadening to include social work. They organize blood donor drives and Sunday block cleanups. But do they also monitor people's politics? The Cuban dancer is that the CDR is the main connection for people who want to express ideas on government policy. For example, the family code was debated for months in CDR meetings before it was finally approved. To critics, these neighbors watching neighbors are spies. To the Cuban government, the CDR is a real way of giving power to the people. The CDR has taken over many of the services once provided by the Catholic Church in Cuba. On Sunday morning in Havana, we saw three closed churches before we found one that was open. We were told that everyone's too busy for church. For instance, Sunday is when the CDR holds street cleanups, and the labor organizations call their workers out for volunteer projects. Another discouragement is that any member of a religion can't belong to the Cuban Communist Party. Only 1% of the population attends church in a country that was strongly Catholic 20 years ago. Now the people are more political than they are religious. Fidel Castro has the place and home displays where once you found religious symbols, right in the middle of the diplomas and the birth certificates. Next we'll meet Castro, the man whose influence is felt everywhere in Cuba.
In our national park, nature is very sweet, unusually serene.
They were scared Americans. Late one evening, with no clear advance warning, the Bellins delegates were summoned to meet Castro. They found a relaxed and jovial man who let his tense bodyguard play the tough role while he stayed the cordial host. But the power he uses with charm, he ran with bullets. Holes still gape in the Moncada barracks in the mountains where Castro made his first military move. He rapidly became a thorn in the side of the United States when he declared himself a communist and permitted Soviet missiles into his country. Castro was so hated that the CIA planned 8 documented attempts to assassinate him. And the feeling was mutual. The devil ranted and raved against the United States. His last trip to New York City ended when he stormed out of his hotel after a bitter speech at the United Nations. But in May 1977, the world's most famous living revolutionary found himself accepting a beer mug with the U.S. Congress insignia on it from Congressman Ron Dellen's aide.
This is from Howard.
Castro surprised his aide by agreeing to answer the delegate's questions in a conversation that began with a jab at lawyers. Fidel is one himself. He led to serious talks about international politics.
Cuba seems to have more of a sense of an international mission, a world struggle, Africa, around the world. Why is that peculiar to? I don't think Cuba is the only country. Others have made a contribution.
because Africa is a perfect land for social revolution. In the next 20 years, it will be one of the most politically advanced regions in the world. It has moved beyond tribalism to nationalism, and one day, even nationalism will be a thing of the past, and humanity will have to live as one family.
Fidel Castro has lately been called the Henry Kissinger of the communist world, a go-between, an unofficial socialist diplomat to third world people. But that outreach worries the United States. Fidel's visit came at the height of tense discussions in the Congress about Cuba's role in Africa. President Jimmy Carter had strongly protested Cuba's move into Ethiopia. Castro met twice privately with Jones and asked him to talk with Carter and explain the Cuban position. It was a definite move away from confrontation.
Every day we're struck that we have military instructors in other countries, but nobody talks about the doctors and technicians we have overseas. Right now, the claim is that we send military instructors to Ethiopia. The staff that we have there is diplomatic, not military. That doesn't mean that we don't have the right to send army instructors. That's our prerogative. If they wish, and if we're able to do it, we will send 311 doctors and public health technicians to Ethiopia.
Cuba also has financial reasons for its outreach to the African countries with their wealth of natural resources. Castro told Ron Dulles his country's main priority for the future is economic development. Ties with the developing countries could mean important trade advantages for Cuba. And Fidel Castro sees his country's relations with the United States changing because of our recent history.
There are several factors for change. The struggle for civil rights, the Vietnam War, the Watergate scandal, and other things that have happened. The American public opinion is aware of the things that are going on. For one example, the years of trade blockade and the hostility against Cuba. Second, the assassination plots, which lasted for 10 years. They lost their prestige. Third, Cuba's influence has not declined. In fact, it has increased, especially in the third world countries. And last, there's a proverb that says, there's no disease that lasts 100 years, nor a body that can survive it.
I'm especially interested in the role of women in formulating policy. And I wonder if you could explain for us the status of women in Cuba.
I think women are still somewhat discriminated against. We keep a close watch on the proportion of women in the ranks of the union leadership compared to the number who participate in production. We watch the proportion of women in the party leadership. Last year, there's progress. And we have to fight against machismo, the mental attitude of men. It's harder to get rid of discrimination against women. I can mention the ban of discrimination against blacks. It's much harder.
Castro says life for blacks in Cuba improved drastically when he nationalized industry and opened up jobs. That move also drove most of the business class from the country in one of the largest mass defections in history. Eventually, about 700,000 people left. The ones who stayed behind and complained about Castro's government, many went to prison. In 1960, Castro admitted to a total of 20,000 political prisoners. Now the number is estimated at 5,000. He says openly that serious dissent against the government he heads is not permitted, and there have been numerous reports in the U.S. press of the execution of political enemies. Castro also said he considers the news media a tool of the government, and not a separate power with freedom to criticize. Yet Cubans seem to love him, in spite of the loss of those freedoms cherished so much in his country. He travels constantly within the country and talks to people wherever he goes. As a result, a surprising number of Cubans have met him personally. Castro calls people his country's best natural resource.
He Economic development is the most serious and difficult problem for all the third world countries. They say that educating people has been our biggest investment. I agree with that. The biggest investment is with people, which I think it is more productive than oil, because oil decreases and people are multiplied.
Fidel Castro is a very charming man, as everyone has said. I suppose the thing that impressed me most was his vision for the future. He already is anticipating that there will be a change, and that young people will see the world through very different eyes from him. And that takes a very wise man to see that. I found him very open in terms of the discussions. I felt very free to ask him what do you consider an embarrassing question, and I didn't feel that he was reluctant to respond to them. Deep loved evaluation of Fidel was shared by many in the delegation. Others found it hard to put together what they read about the man with the cordial person they met. It's important to remember his military beginnings and his power. It's impossible to forget his way with words and with people.
What happened?
Castro has economic reasons for welcoming Americans. He wants the tourist business to return. Next, we'll see what Cuba has to offer the new tourists.
Hey, look.
Could look and sound like Havana before the revolution. The music is big band style, and the dances are produced like Las Vegas showstoppers. They are elaborately staged with spectacular light shows and sets that could have come out of a Busby Berkeley movie. The dancers are dressed like they were in the old days, when Cuba was the hotspot for Americans who wanted to spend a wild weekend. However, there's one noticeable difference.
The elaborate Tropicana. All the dancers are beautiful, the singers are talented, but all the messages are revolutionary.
This is the most vivid example of the contradictions Cuba shows to its new American visitors. The Las Vegas-style showgirls sing about imperialism. The people in the audience dance for hours to an odd mix of Hollywood show tunes and political songs. Most tourists just can't get over the surprise of finding a socialist country with a Latin style. Would provide an appealing combination for Americans.
It's the only place in their hemisphere that they can see a country young and struggling on a different direction, and using different dynamics than their own to solve their problems, and I think it's wonderful.
Most of the people who jumped at the chance to be among the first American tourists back to Cuba did it for more than fun. They were politically curious, and after a quick look around, each one seemed to take a stand, either for or against what they saw.
It was very frightening as you come off the boat and there are police there and it's under heavy security.
Our exposure to the Cuban people made me feel, wow, we've got a long way to go in America. Maybe we ought to turn backwards because they've got something special. They're so open and warm. What we lack as a people.
And they had, and this was a relatively neutral show, Russian propaganda, Russian acrobats, Russian and Soviet music, Russian and Soviet influence. And the only thing I could think of was that we in the United States just took a lot more care to, to prevent this by giving the kind of aid to countries like Cuba, which would prevent this from happening.
Thank you.
show, one tourist even said it was worth the whole trip just for that one evening. But there was some grumbling about the cost of cigars. A box of 25 of the famous Monte Cristos cost about $15. Americans can bring back $100 worth of Cuban goods duty-free. But if you go over the limit, U.S. customs officials simply remove you of the extras. Rum is another tourist buy in Cuba, about $6 a bottle. But after cigars and rum, there's not much else in the hotel stores except souvenir t-shirts and dolls. Other than buying in your hotel, for the tourists, there are just a few other places that you can buy. One of them is in a square in the downtown shopping area, where you find all kinds of things, like pictures of Cuba, little necklaces and trinkets that you can purchase, or maybe little hair barrettes for girls. There are all kinds of little toys, some household items, and so there are a few things that you can buy. These kinds of things the tourists are used to looking for. Americans should be warned that the U.S. dollar is only worth 80 cents in Cuba. There aren't many places for open shopping, and foreigners are not allowed to buy in the strictly controlled department stores. While shopping in Cuba is only fair, hotel accommodations are not much better. There are only 5 luxury hotels in Havana with a total of less than 2,000 rooms. At one time, this was the Hilton Hotel in Havana. Now it's called the Havana Libre. More than just the hotel name has changed since Castro. In Havana's $40 a night rooms, furniture may be 20 years old, hot water is sometimes scarce, and a phone call to the U.S. can take 8 hours to arrange. Finding a taxi can also take hours, and hiring one for the day costs up to $100. To enjoy Cuba, you probably have to give up the idea of a luxurious vacation, because this country is more interesting than it is glamorous. For the nostalgic, there's a chance to see how the city that was the richest in the Caribbean has changed under socialism. Havana is full of houses built before the revolution with imported Spanish tile and elaborate grillwork. The houses are still in good shape, but most are government offices now or have been given to labor organizations. Some are communes. We visited one huge estate in the countryside that's been turned into a restaurant with an atmosphere we'd expect the Castro Society to consider decadent. But there it was, in the middle of socialist Cuba. Available in Cuba, but much of a visitor's experience is more serious, even educational. In Cuba, if you're invited to visit a museum, you're probably not being asked to come and look at paintings or sculpture or anything of that sort. But what you're being asked to do is to come and review some of Cuba's history, and of course, to look at the photographs and memorabilia of the revolution. The government has been training tour guides for 2 years. Their favorite topic is the Castro takeover that was plotted in Cuba, Sierra Maestra. Oriente Province, more than 400 miles from Havana, was full of sites like the water well where revolutionaries hid their guns and the printing press they used while they tried to win support. Learning about Cuba's history may be unavoidable for tourists, but what most seem to want is contact with the people, and that's easy to find. Even Congressman Ron Bellins, who had to stick to a government itinerary, found talking to the Cuban people a highlight.
I didn't see many police around. I didn't see many military personnel around. So I didn't get the sense of a closed military, police state kind of situation. I saw very few kind of people moving. And how their body language, the music, how they communicated with us and communicated with themselves. I didn't feel the tension. I didn't sense that among people.
Here's a little more of the delegate's impressions of Cuba.
Evening Magazine on Channel 5. Do You Know the Way to San Jose was the title of a popular song.